Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Today, NSPR is proud to congratulate Nancy on her 400th episode of the show. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
What does the Book of Genesis have to say about the human brain? Plenty, says my guest, Glenda Lee Hoffman. Her book is The Secret Dowry of Eve. She suggests that Genesis is a coded text, that the Garden of Eden is actually a metaphor for the psyche, and that understanding the code shifts the brain's perception, allowing us to see how we can become the extraordinary person we've always wanted to be. Well, Glenda Lee, how did you ever come up with this idea that Genesis had anything to do with the human brain?
I know. Isn't that fascinating? I actually didn't come up with that idea. The idea was brought to me by synchronicity, dreams, visions. I was as astonished to think about it as anybody would be. But I did study the Kabbalah for many years. And
well, maybe I should say that this was before you came to Chico.
I started studying the Kabbalah back in the 70s when I lived at a New Age seminary, I've learned to call it, called the Christ Circle. It was in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And I studied there from 1973 to 1978. And I was the only student that studied the Kabbalah. It was introduced to us by one of the teachers, but it was very difficult to study, so everyone else dropped out. But I was so fascinated by it, and I didn't even know why, because I couldn't understand it. And after several months, I had a vision. It was very powerful, and it just knocked my socks off. And then I knew, oh, this is powerful stuff.
Well, the only contact most of us have with or hearing the word Kabbalah or Kabbalah, it's pronounced different ways, was with Madonna when she, I guess she's still fascinated by the Kabbalah, I don't know, but how can you help us to understand the Kabbalah?
I still study the Kabbalah, and I've never heard the word pronounced by an expert, so I have no idea if I'm saying it right or you're saying it right or if there's a right way to say it.
Well, even when it's spelled in English, you see it sometimes spelled mm-hmm. with a Q and sometimes with a C and sometimes with a K, more often probably with a K. In your book, you spell it with a Q.
I do because and there are several branches of Kabbalah, which is perhaps why it's spelled differently. The branch that I studied is related to the Hebrew alphabet. And it is based on the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and the spelling comes from that. And the reason it's spelled with a Q is because that's the letter Kaf, which is a specific letter in the alphabet, and the teaching is relating the information from that letter. So it's spelled with a Q.
So you had this vision that you should be studying the Kabbalah, but then what did you do with that?
Well, that was just the first. And I had the vision as a result of studying the Kabbalah, as a result of studying the first word of Genesis for 9 months.
The first word?
The first word. My teacher told me, if you can get the first word, you'll be okay. And it took me 9 months to get the first word. And the reason that it is so difficult is because the language of Kabbalah is not linguistic and it's not linear. It's a very unique language. There's no other language like it. It's a language of patterns. And your brain has to be presented with these patterns over and over and over. And it has to try to work with them, even though working with them will not reveal the patterns. The intention to work with them opens up a space someplace in consciousness or in the mind. The Kabbalah, what happens with the Kabbalah, and I've only recently discovered this, or I've only recently discovered how to say this. What happens is that the human mind is incapable of actually perceiving the patterns that the Kabbalah is presenting. But through effort and intention, the space opens, and then the energy that the Kabbalah is based on, which is a pattern in the universe, that energy actually somehow enters your mind and presents itself to you. That's what happens. And when you see that, that's what I saw. The first word of Genesis, which is Bereshit, Beit, Resh, Aleph, Shin, Yad, Tav. That has been translated as in the beginning. But the real translation of that word is the cosmic seed of life. And what I saw in my vision after 9 months was the cosmic seed of life. And I knew it. I was in the center of it, and it was everywhere. And the cosmic seed of life was what was the beginning that generated the whole universe and everything in it. So how do you explain that? I mean, that's beyond words. That's beyond meaning. And yet I was in the center of that.
In fact, as you were talking, I was trying to imagine if I were a translator trying to put that into English.
Yeah.
All that in that first
and
word.
And the magical thing about the Kabbalah is that every word in Genesis, at least the first four chapters, is written exactly the same way. Every word is a lifetime of experience. I don't know who wrote this, but I've had that same experience with multiple words in that story, which is why I keep going back to it, because it's like having 10,000 orgasms. There's no experience like it. It is so mind-blowing and so uplifting and connecting. It's like a near-death experience, but you never die and you're not even close to death. You just get taken to the center of the universe and the center of yourself.
Okay, this is getting a little hard to follow, I think, but let's get back to the fact that Eve is in the title of your book, The Secret Dowry of Eve.
Yes.
So how did you get from studying the Kabbalah to this character, Eve, who is the bad guy in the story?
Isn't that interesting that she became the bad guy? Because in the story, she is the one who remains in the Garden of Eden, and she gives birth to Cain, who has been interpreted to be the bad brother. But in truth, if you actually read the story, Cain is the one who said, I'm going to go live in the land of Nod there, in the east of Eden, next to the tree of life. Now, that's right in Genesis. And so it defines who Cain's character is. But the interpretation that Cain has been given by those experts or theologians who self-define themselves as the people who can interpret the Bible, they have given Cain and Eve a very bad name that they don't deserve. And the reason I came up with Eve is because as I was reading the story and translating it through the Kabbalah, I began to realize that the Kabbalah is a whole story about fundamental energies in the universe. And the best way for us to understand these energies is to think of a seed. And of course, the story takes place in a garden. What the Kabbalah teaches us about seeds is that the germ and the husk have very different properties and very different activities, and it's very important for us to understand their differences. The germ is the inner element, the husk is the outer element, but they always work together. They always work together to create life. The inner element is feminine, the outer element is masculine, and this is mirrored in our genitals. Women's genitals are in their bodies, men's genitals are outside their bodies. But this pattern carries through multiple dimensions. A seed is, the germ is discontinuous, the husk is continuous. The husk is structure, the germ is unstructured. The germ is, disruptive. The germ is disruptive.
Which we would think is a bad thing.
Right.
You don't want to be disruptive.
Exactly.
But what you mean by that is discontinuous.
Discontinuous. And the reason it's disruptive is because life is disruptive. When a bud bursts out of the point of the branch on a tree, that it's disrupting the tree, but it's disrupting the tree with life. So when you learn this language of the Kabbalah, you realize that this disruptive feminine element is not something to be devalued. It's something to be rejoiced in. And when I began to understand that, and then I began to look at Eve differently. She is not who she's been
portrayed.
No, not at all. She is the savior of the story. Right in the story, it says that when Adam was given the commandment to not eat of the fruit, that if he did, he would die. But when Eve eats the fruit first and then gives it to him,
Nobody dies.
Nobody dies. But for some reason, this perception of her as his savior, because that's what she does, she saves him from death, is not understood by people. And now that I see this story this way, it just blows my mind that people have been given this superficial interpretation of the story that doesn't even go along with the words that are in the book.
I think that's part of the problem, is that we assume that we know this story. Therefore, we don't need to read it because we know this story.
Yeah.
And yet, if we really go back and read it, it's rather hard to read because we think we know this story, but when you look at what the words say, it's quite contradictory.
That's what
it's
happens.
Inconsistent.
Exactly.
There's more than one story, even.
There is more than one story. There's the story in Genesis 1, which is the 7 days of creation. Actually, the 6 days, because Genesis 2 begins the seventh day. And then there's the story in Genesis 2, 3, and 4, which is the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. These are two very different stories. And again, they portray the two sides of the seed, the husk and the germ. The first story, the cosmology, the 6 days of creation, is a husk story. It's a story about the outer world. The second story, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, is a mythology. And you can see that the snake talked to the woman and she ate the fruit and then she got her eyes open. That's mythology. The mythology points to the inner world. So you've got the outer world with the cosmology of Genesis 1, and you've got the inner world, the mythology of Genesis 2, 3, and 4. Well, that's a husk and a germ. That's an inner and an outer. And this inner world is the world of our internal awareness, the human awareness that we are all endowed with. And that's why the title is The Secret Dowry of Eve, because Eve represents a specific part of our human awareness, that is unique to us because we get it through the frontal lobe.
Ah, okay, so there's where the brain comes in.
Yes.
So that's the connection with the brain and Genesis.
Genesis is actually, when you understand this code that the Kabbalah presents, that this language of seeds, the husk and the germ, the husk is outer, the germ is inner, the outer is masculine, the inner is feminine. When you understand this pattern and then you read this story, you realize that this inner feminine element in the human brain that Eve represents, this frontal lobe, is the distinguishing uniqueness that makes us human. We are the only creatures on the planet, that have a brain, the neural substrate of the frontal lobe, and it is so unique. And we know so little about it. It just amazes me. We are who we are because of the frontal lobe, and yet no one seems to know this.
So your study of the Kabbalah led you to understand Genesis in a different way, which led you to the study of the brain. And so if this frontal lobe, you might just briefly tell us about the brain generally.
Well, the way that the brain evolved is it evolved through the four major terrestrial epochs on Earth. The reptilian, the mammalian, the hominid, and the human. What happened with science is that they understood the difference between the reptilian and the mammalian, and those two areas of the brain are separate and are recognized and are scientifically named. The reptilian part of the brain is called the R-complex, and the mammalian part of the brain is called the limbic cortex. But the neocortex has always been associated with human evolution. And it's always been looked at as one unit that evolved through that 8 million years that we're calling ourselves human. But the way that I was looking at the brain, the way that the Genesis and the Kabbalah taught me to look at the brain, which is pay attention to the disruptive element, I began to realize that the neocortex should be two pieces. It should be the neocortex and then the frontal lobe, because the frontal lobe disrupts the neocortex evolution with a brand new type of awareness. And the way that this works out through the senses is The reptilian brain processes chemical through the taste and smell. The limbic brain processes auditory sensory signals because the earliest mammals were nocturnal. And in order for them to survive, their auditory processing had to be supreme. The hominids, which are the prehumans, these are the bipedal primates, their major sensory processing organ was the eyes. So vision was their processing unit. And of course, vision is all takes up the whole back part of the neocortex of the human brain. And then the frontal lobes, the unique part of the frontal lobes is that they also use a visionary apparatus, but instead of looking outward, which is what the neocortex does, the frontal lobes look inward to the brain itself. So all of the spiritual attributes that we refer to in insight and mysticism and spirituality, all those occur because we are able to look within ourselves. And that's what the frontal lobe does. When we look within ourselves, our main goal is to decipher whether or not we are living up to our own intentions. And that's kind of the crux of spirituality and our own happiness. If we're living up to our own intentions, then we will be forging our pathway. What happens to us is we get all caught up in the neocortex because it's looking outward to the world, and our culture rewards us for this. And so we kind of get buried in the neocortex, and we forget that we have this frontal lobe that has this ability, this unique ability, to look inward. And it's from looking inward that we change. If we're constantly looking outward, we can't change. Looking inward allows us to change, and it's change. It's the human ability to adapt and change that makes us unique as creatures on this planet. We, more than any creature that lives on planet Earth, are adaptable and change because we have this frontal lobe, this unbelievable wealth of neural mass in our brains. And that's what the story in Genesis told me.
But yet most of us resist change. We don't welcome change. We like things, the status quo. We think that's good.
We think we do. Yeah, we think we do. And yet if you look within yourself, you'll see that you're not happy with the status quo. The status quo is incomplete. And it's our habits, it's our conditioning, and it's our desire to be like everybody else that wants to be like the status quo. But if you look inside yourself, you'll see that you want something else. You want to be whole. Yeah, you want that germ that's going to move you to the next phase of your own journey. And that's what Eve represents.
And in fact, the subtitle in your book is Woman's Role in the Development of Consciousness. So your book is also about evolution in the sense of evolving your consciousness.
Yes, what I discovered is that if you look at the brain like a seed and through the pattern of the Kabbalah, which is inner and outer, the four lobes line up perfectly with that pattern. The reptilian is outward focusing. The limbic is inward focusing in the sense that it processes all of our emotions and feelings. The neocortex is outward focusing through vision, and the frontal lobe is inward focusing through vision. So the human brain itself follows this pattern of outer, inner, and that outer and inner can be seen as masculine, feminine. So all of us are very finely tuned and balanced. What happens because of our culture, because our culture is so masculinized, we've all been conditioned through very masculine values, principles, structures of organization. Our political, our economic structures are all very masculine, and we think this is normal. And the truth is, it isn't normal at all. It's simply the way we've conditioned ourselves since the Greeks.
And you do make the point in your book, too, that you're not male bashing,
nope.
that women also are caught up in this masculinization.
Very much.
Of your outlook.
What I mean by that is we value the material world more than the inner world. This is our culture again. We value doing things more than we value self-knowledge. Those are the masculine values. The feminine values are self-knowledge is the highest kind of knowledge. And this is what Eve represents in Genesis, is this high knowledge, this high awareness of self-knowledge. And so she's my hero.
Well,
and she's within all of us. I mean, the point is she's a universal image. She's the frontal lobe. All of us have a frontal lobe. The frontal lobe in portraying these feminine qualities, I'm not talking about I don't even want to go there, actually. The feminine qualities that Eve represents are things like equality, because the masculine counterpoint to equality is hierarchical, and men always self-organize hierarchically. But humans, and that's how animals self-organize, is through hierarchies. But humans are not meant to do that. Humans are meant to disrupt the hierarchy that animals evolved and develop equality. And we've tried to with democracy, but we haven't gotten very far, really. And one of the reasons is because we don't recognize women as holding the key to true equality.
So if we really understood this first book of the Bible and understood the lesson and understood the dowry of Eve, we would live happier lives.
Oh, we would live much happier lives. The whole thing is geared towards happiness. If we knew ourselves, we would understand that the thing we love the most is to be close with our family, to have a loving husband or a loving partner, to be related to our children in a way that they provide us joy and fulfillment. Whereas today in most families, people squabble all the time. They're not happy. And that used to be how it was in my family until I learned how to encompass all my Eve qualities and let them be the focus of my life rather than taking my cues from the outer world. It was a huge transition, but I tell everybody now, I get to live in heaven because my marriage is so wonderful.
Well, I was interested in the fact that you had someone write a foreword to your book, Joseph Chilton Pierce, and he has quite a list of adjectives for your book. He says that your book is remarkable, brilliant, unique, enlightening, intriguing, challenging, and exasperating.
Yeah, he had a
difficult time. And I think maybe you've given us an example of how all of these things. But now, you were just going to say, why did he find it exasperating?
Oh, I know why he did. He did not like the fact that the frontal lobe was feminine. He just, that was a place he could not go. He had studied the frontal lobe. One of the reasons he enjoyed my book so much is because at the time that he read my manuscript, which was back in 1999, no one was talking about the frontal lobe. And he was so, he got my manuscript and read it in one reading. He stayed up all night and read it. But he struggled so much with that feminine image. And it's interesting, that's so ironic, because Joe Pierce is, of course, such a supporter of women's rights and especially women's rights in childbirth and in breastfeeding children. And yet he was challenged by this image of part of the brain being feminine, the major human part. So it took him a while to come around.
So maybe he needed a better understanding of what you meant by this masculine-feminine being not one better or worse or good or bad or evil.
But
that they're essential parts of a whole.
Yes, exactly. I think that's what he struggled with. And when he finally realized that is when he wrote that introduction for me. Yeah.
Yeah, because he says, a major theme in your book is your description of our twin tendencies of continuity leading to stagnation and despair, and discontinuity or disruption leading to transcendence and newness.
Yeah. And doesn't he say that beautifully?
Yes.
And that is the key right there. That's the key, that when these two work together, that they do it like an alternating current. At one point, the disruptive energy will be in the forefront. At another point, the continuity energy will be in the forefront, because that's what we need. We need a balance of both. We need a constant movement of both of those energies through our life.
And so the two tendencies together create a wholeness.
And see, those are the energies of the seed, the disruptive germ and the continuous husk. And all of us, I mean, this is what's so amazing about the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah gives us the definitions and the window through which to see this kind of a pattern. The whole universe is self-generated and self-organized according to these energies, this German husk, this discontinuity and continuity. When you begin to, and even the phases of history, if you study them, pretty soon you'll start to see they go on this same alternating current. And so it's fascinating to me to see this pattern.
And normally we're having to use our brain to look at our brain. And he makes the point, Joe Pierce does, Kabbalah offered a way by which the brain could look at itself.
Yeah, that was... When I first studied the Kabbalah, of course, I didn't know that. I had no idea I was studying anything about the brain. I was studying the forces of creation, the self-generative forces and the self-organization forces. That's what I learned with the Kabbalah. When I started reading about the brain, and especially Paul MacLean's information about the triune brain, that was something started jarring me. And I thought, oh, there's something here. What is this? And I just dug deeper and deeper and deeper until one day, 10, 15 years later, I had the huge aha. Oh my, this is all together.
My guest is Glenda Lee Hoffman. We've been talking about her book, The Secret Dowry of Eve, Woman's Role in the Development of Consciousness. But she also, in addition to her writing, is assistant director of the Learning Research Institute in Chico, which is a learning center that offers students who struggle sometimes hundreds of brain exercises to increase their academic success. So you're using this information that you study the brain to actually apply it and help students who may be struggling.
Right. Actually, our website is learningiship.org, H-I-P. HIP stands for Hoffman Integration Process. This is not something I developed. This is something my mother developed. This was her PhD thesis. My mother is a psychologist, and she was a special ed teacher in the Cupertino School District for 23 years. And through that time, she had to deal with all these struggling students and could not help them and was so frustrated because of that. She decided to find a way to help these students. So she tested literally hundreds of programs. And what she ended up doing was combining elements of several different ones, and then she came up with part of her own. And now we have a tested and proven method that actually reorganizes the brain of struggling students. The reason students struggle is because they can't process information. And they come to school with these problems. They're pre-academic. So we give them a series of exercises that helps bring their brain up to speed by focusing on three areas: visual, auditory, and motor.
So that website, again, if you want to check that out, it sounds fascinating, www.learningiship.org. And the HIP is Hoffman, but not you, Glenda Lee Hoffman, but your mother.
Lee Hoffman.
Yes. We're going to take a break now. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Glenda Lee about a book on the new science of neuroplasticity that she highly recommends. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm back continuing my conversation with Glenda Lee Hoffman. She is the director of the Hoffman Learning Research Institute in Chico, and her life's work involves researching the brain's methods and potentials for learning. She has written two books based on her studies of the Kabbalah and the brain. The first book was The Secret Dowry of Eve, Woman's Role in the Development of Consciousness. And then she wrote a second book, The Genesis Code, Your Key to Unlocking Hidden Genius. But I'd like to talk to her now about the brain's plasticity and why she so highly recommends a book by Dr. Norman Doidge on this science called neuroplasticity. And the title of his book is The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science. So Glenda Lee Hoffman, welcome back.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Glenda Lee. And I refer to this as the new science of neuroplasticity, but it doesn't seem that new to me. It's been around for a while, this notion of the brain's plasticity. So why are people still calling it new?
Well, actually, until 1999, most scientists and most neuroscientists did not even believe or acknowledge neuroplasticity. There was a few experiments done in 1999 that proved neuroplasticity was alive and real. And it still is a struggle for some scientists to accept how plastic, and by the term plastic, we simply mean change. The brain changes. And the title of this book that we're talking about today is called The Brain That Changes Itself. But even today, even the people who accept neuroplasticity, most people still have no idea just how malleable the brain is.
And you have a lot of books about the brain in your own personal library.
Yes,
you happen to have said that you do. But this book in particular, I think because it maybe it's more accessible.
Yes.
Because it tells stories.
Yes. Yeah. This Norman Doidge is a Canadian psychoanalyst. And he got personally interested in neuroplasticity as a method learning, teaching himself so that he could help his patients. And what he found out was so remarkable, he couldn't stop himself from writing about it because people were changing their lives. They were changing everything about them as they headed for their personal goals. For instance, I'll just look in the book.
Now, I just want to repeat because this is so hard to believe that people can change their brain, intentionally make changes that change their brain.
Well, every thought we think, every movement we make, everything we hear, everything we say, all of these little things already change the brain. I mean, the brain is not static in any sense at all. So it's constantly changing. It's just that our concepts and our perception of the brain are still somewhat static. So the reason I like this book by Norman Doidge is because he searched out people who were doing neuroplastic research, but not also simply everyday people who were changing their lives drastically because they wanted to, and the neuroplasticity fit into that story. So the book is simply full of stories of people that he met and researched. And while he's telling the story, he educates us about neuroplasticity.
My guest is Glenda Lee Hoffman, and she is going to tell us about this book by Dr. Norman Doidge, The Brain That Changes Itself. And these are stories of personal triumph from the frontiers of brain science. And you have something you can read to
right.
us from his book?
This is just from the preface, and I want to read it because he is a wonderful writer, and he says it better than I can. In the course of my travels, I met a scientist who enabled people who had been blind since birth to begin to see, another who enabled the deaf to hear. I spoke with people who had had strokes decades before and had been declared incurable, who were helped to recover with neuroplastic treatments. I met people whose learning disorders were cured and whose IQs were raised. I saw evidence that it is possible for 80-year-olds to sharpen their memories to function the way they did when they were 55. I saw people rewire their brains with their thoughts to cure previously incurable obsessions and traumas. I spoke with Nobel laureates who were hotly debating how we must rethink our model of the brain now that we know it is ever-changing.
This is my guest, Glenda Lee Hoffman, reading from a book by Dr. Norman Doidge. He is a Canadian psychotherapist, did you say?
Yes, psychoanalyst.
Psychoanalyst. And you're reading from this book. That sounds pretty amazing, Glenda Lee.
Yes, it's a wonderful book because it's so accessible. He is first of all, he's a great story writer. And when I first read the book, I'm wondering, how does he become such a wonderful story writer? And I realized, well, a psychoanalyst, basically he sits in an office and listens to stories all day. So it's kind of a natural transition for him. But like his first chapter is this fabulous story about a woman named Cheryl Schlitz who lost her entire balance mechanism. And it was because of the fault of a medical procedure. She had a hysterectomy, and she was given an antibiotic that she took too long. She didn't know this, and the doctor simply prescribed it too long. And one of the side effects, and she's not the only person who's experienced this, is that it destroyed her vestibular system. And she felt like she was always falling, even when she was just laying down. She couldn't navigate across a room without toppling. She had been bed-bound and chair-bound for 5 years before she met a man named Paul Bacchirita. His name, I'll spell it for you, B-A-C-H-Y, separate Y, and Rita, R-I-T-A. He, I think, was a Spanish, not only a physician, but a rehabilitative physician. So he was very interested in how to use medical science to help people recover various functions. And he would take people on a case-by-case basis. He wasn't necessarily interested in research. He just had this brilliant mind. And so he met Cheryl Schlitz and he heard about her problem. And he began to think of ways that he could help her train her brain to recover some of this balance. And so he came upon the idea of the tongue being a midline organ. And I can't remember why that was so important, but he developed a little plate that gave off electrical signals, kind of like a tiny little shock, but not unpleasant. It felt more like champagne bubbles. And they were in a specific pattern. And she would put this plate on her tongue and immediately regained her balance. I mean, it happened instantly. And he didn't know in the beginning why this happened the way that it did. But he had, through his research, he had an intuition that it might work. And sure enough, it worked instantly. And she was totally amazed because for the first time in 5 years, she could stand straight and not feel that dizzying nausea that you have when, have you ever experienced vertigo?
Yeah.
Well, she had it all the time, no matter what position she was in. And for the first time in 5 years, she didn't have it. And not only did it work when she had the plate on her tongue, but then there was this residual effect. The brain was actually teaching itself how to make her vestibular system work again. And the reason it was doing that is because it was growing new neurons. So she would put this thing on her tongue, she would gain her equilibrium back, and then the brain would realize this is what she wants. And so it would figure out ways to hook old neurons into new patterns. And her the extension of time after she stopped using the plate would get longer and longer. So if she wore the plate for an hour, for the first week, it would extend, her balance would extend for a couple hours after that hour. And then that time would get longer and longer so that after 4 months, she actually no longer needed it. She had regained completely her entire sense of balance. And when you realize that this woman was completely debilitated for 5 years, and then here comes a man who thinks completely outside the box and he gives her life back in 4 months. To me, it's remarkable. He then went on to...
Without drugs or surgery,
yeah,
or our usual tools,
yes,
that we
just
resort
this
to.
Very simple little mechanism that interfaced with the brain in a similar way to biofeedback.
That's what it sounded like.
Right. Then. It helped the brain develop a new perception. And that's what biofeedback is. It helps the brain develop a new perception so that it can change either a behavior or a thought or a feeling or something to go along with your intention that helps you train your brain to go in that direction and leave behind whatever negative elements might be in that pattern.
I can see why you're so excited about this, because you have an institute of learning,
yes.
but I'm assuming that when you started this, you were thinking in terms of like academic, helping school children perhaps learn
yes. Yes.
better. But this is such a, yes. is a different kind of learning.
Yes. I have always been interested in the brain, because what most people don't understand, we're all walking around with a brain inside our heads. What the fundamental thing that most of us do not understand is that the brain does not process vision. It does not process sounds. It does not process taste. It does not process smells. It doesn't process touch. None of, the minute those signals go into the brain transforms those signals into electricity. They're just pulses. That's all they are. The brain, in fact, the reason that brain surgery can take place after they drill into your skull, then you don't need any pain medications, because the brain has no pain receptors. So there was a man, Wilder Penfield, back in the 50s. He did brain research on people who had epilepsy, and he would put probes in the brain while they were awake, and they would tell him what was going on in their brain at where he would put the probe. And some of Bucky Rita's information started with Wilder Penfield's information, because he saw how Penfield was mapping the brain. But after Bucky Rita helped this woman, Cheryl Schlitz, he went on to develop a flexible device that blind people would wear on their back. And it had electrodes, and it did the same thing as the tongue mechanism. And he wired it to a camera that they wore right next to their face. And this camera videoed whatever the landscape was, where the people were. And then it would imprint the outline of the images on this receiver plate that was on these people's back. And their skin was sending these signals to the brain, and the brain could interpret it as a map of obstacles. They couldn't see color, they couldn't see perspective, but they could see that there was a square object or an object that looked like a human, and that there was a pathway here. And so these people that had been blind from birth could navigate a landscape. They could see, quote unquote, that something was moving, and that it would go in their path. And it gave them enormous freedom. And then he shrunk that device down into the size of your tongue. And he put that on their tongue. This man was so outside the box. And this is back in the 60s and 70s, when nobody was thinking like this. He was just a fabulous man. And I knew about Paul Bucky Rita before I read this book. But
it sounds like he didn't have a good publicity agent, because he is not well known.
No, he's not well known at all. But Paul Bucky Rita wasn't interested in publicity. He was interested in helping people. That his mission was to solve problems. And that's what he did. The reason I knew about him is because his father was a professor in a university in Brazil. Brazil? I think it was Brazil. South America, sorry. And his father was a wonderful academician, but he suffered a full stroke, I think at about the age of 70, whole left side of his body completely paralyzed. And Bucky Rita's brother was also a physician. And his brother took his father home, and within a matter of months had helped his father through several tiny little exercises that became longer and longer, helped his father within 3 years. Again, this is back in the 60s, completely recover from this stroke. And it was a massive stroke. And Bucky Rita, I know this will sound a little bit gruesome to some people, but when his father died, Bucky Rita did an autopsy on his brain. And he found that there was a space about a quarter, the size of a quarter, where the stroke had completely killed off every single neuron in that space. But all around it was just this massive growth of new neurons that had taken place during this 3 years of training. I mean, he couldn't even talk, this man. He couldn't talk, he couldn't drive, he couldn't read, he couldn't write, he couldn't do anything. And the whole one side of his body. I think it was his, it was right side because he had left hemisphere stroke. So, and this is before people were doing any kind of neuroplastic research. And based on that work, Paul Bacchiarita's brother, a man named Taub, who maybe even currently has an institute in Alabama, and the story, again, is in Deutsch's book, he developed a clinic specifically for stroke and trauma victims that is still working today. And he has done further work on this, developing exercises. And the way that they start out is when the victims come in, the doctor and the staff put slings or mitts on the good arm or the good leg, forcing the people to use, and they have to start with just moving a finger. If you can move a finger, they've figured out how to get your body with all these exercises. And they're brutal. You have to do them 8 hours a day. But these are people that don't have any other alternative, and so they're working really hard. But within a couple of years, they're regaining all this lost activity. And what they've discovered is that it doesn't matter how long ago the stroke was. It doesn't have to be 6 months. It can be 40 years ago. And there are instances of people gaining more than 50% of their movement and their abilities back.
My guest is Glenda Lee Hoffman, and she's the director of the Hoffman Learning Research Institute in Chico. Her life's work has been researching the brain's methods and potential for learning, but she is especially impressed by a book by Dr. Norman Doidge on the science of neuroplasticity. And Glenda Lee, I think you have some sections you want to read from Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself.
Yeah, I was just talking about Paul Bacchiarita, and I turned the page, and there's this great little quote here that Doidge uses. He says, recently, Bacchiarita's work has inspired cognitive scientist Andy Clark to wittily argue that we are natural-born cyborgs. In other words, our brain can change itself so drastically that it can instantly extend itself into whatever technologies and machines we use to supplement deficiencies in our own systems. For instance, glasses. I mean, before glasses were invented, people who got old couldn't see very well, so they couldn't do any fine work. Well, now you put on glasses and your brain instantly adjusts because now it can see. Or hearing aids. Or, you know, now most people know that there is a program that you have an electrode put in your brain, and if you're a quadriplegic, you can operate with only your mind, a robotic arm that will write for you. It will pick up a teacup and allow you to drink tea. It will play video games and operate a computer. I mean, 20 years ago, nobody ever even thought anything like this was possible. So, yes, we are natural-born cyborgs, and we're going to see a lot more of this in the future.
And you told us a story about a woman who had extreme vertigo and was cured. We could say cured.
Yes, she was cured. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then the next story that Doidge tells is about a woman who had severe, I mean, incredibly severe learning deficiencies. But somewhat like a savant, she also had certain brilliant talents. And she struggled all the way through school. And in college, she began to study herself and study her own brain because she had these little windows of brilliance. And she, by doing a lot of research and especially with a man named Luria, who was a Russian scientist, and I know about him because when my mother and I first put the Hoffman Learning Research together, he was one of her research experts. So I already had this respect for Luria, but what this woman, Barbara Arrowsmith Young, she's also Canadian, she started studying Luria, and one of the stories that she read in Luria's research was about a soldier, a Russian soldier named Lyova Zazetsky. And what had happened to Zazetsky is that he had been shot, and the bullet had lodged in his brain, and he experienced these very bizarre perceptions. And Luria found out later that the bullet had lodged in a place in the brain where the temporal lobe, which normally processes sound and language, the occipital lobe, which normally processes visual images, and the parietal lobe, which normally processes spatial relationships and integrates information from the different senses, it had lodged in a place where those three meet. And so Zazetsky could not understand the relationships between symbols. And he could also no longer understand logic, cause and effect, or spatial relationships. So as this woman, Barbara Arrowsmith, is reading about Zazetsky, she's realizing that all of his experiences were exactly like hers. And she was just astonished because her experiences were so odd. No one could figure out what to do with them. One of the things, she could never read a clock. It just didn't make any sense to her at all. So she set about developing her own exercises and teaching herself. And she did this through just brutal repetition, months. She developed clocks with not only minute and hour and second hands, but with days of the week and months. I mean, she developed these incredibly complicated clocks because once she taught herself how to read the hour and minute and second
hands, the clock.
Right? Then she wanted to train her brain better. So she now has a school in Canada for students with learning deficiencies, and she uses most of the methods that she used on herself to help them improve these deficiencies. And a lot of the exercises she does are similar to the ones that we've developed in the Hoffman Learning Research Institute. And again, based on neuroplasticity, because the brain, given stimuli, cannot help but respond to it. So if you give it the right kind of stimuli, and especially for learning deficiencies, what you do is you start with something very simple and you repeat it. And it's a very short exercise, less than a minute. You repeat that exercise several times, and then you just incrementally expand it. And you do this in a systematic way with several different exercises, maybe 20 or 30. And within a couple of months, a child who can't read starts reading, even though you're not using reading exercises. You're using simply exercises that match symbols with meaning in a rudimentary way. And the brain takes over its plasticity, and it makes these patterns. And because the brain itself is already organized to learn, learning begins to take place on its own.
My guest is Linda Lee Hoffman, who is director of the Hoffman Learning Research Institute in Chico. And she has actually written two books herself based on her studies of the Kabbalah and the brain. Her first book was The Secret Dowry of Eve, Woman's Role in the Development of Consciousness. Her second book was The Genesis Code, Your Key to Unlocking Hidden Genius. And we're talking about this new science of neuroplasticity, and in particular, a book that Glenda Lee recommends by Dr. Norman Doidge, The Brain That Changes Itself.
Yeah, The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science. I love this book. I've read it several times. We have it here. I'm showing it to Nancy.
I know. Just every page
it's all
is highlighted and noted, yes.
So after the story of Barbara Arrowsmith, Doidge introduces a man who I've known for about a long time. His name is Michael Merzenich, and he's the one who developed the brain game called Lumosity. You hear the commercials on television, radio, all over. That's him. That's Michael Merzenich. I'm going to read a quote from Deutsch here. And he's quoting Merzenich. The cerebral cortex, Merzenich says, is the thin outer layer of the brain, the part of the brain that looks like a walnut, quote, is actually selectively refining its processing capacities to fit each task at hand, unquote. It doesn't simply learn. It is always learning how to learn. So the brain is constantly refining its own learning methods. Most people don't realize this, but, you know, I used to experience when I was younger playing tennis. I would practice a certain tennis move, whether serving or, and then I wouldn't play for a couple of days, and I would come back and I could do it better. I always thought, what is that? And of course, they talk about, the neuroscientists talk about this thing called consolidation. Once you've stimulated your brain with a bunch of new activities or new facts or that you want to learn, say you're studying for a test, you need to give the brain time to consolidate all that information. It's more efficient that way. So most neuroscientists who work with people now understand that, and they don't drive you until you're exhausted.
In fact, I think that is part of why we sleep.
Yes, it is. I mean, neuroscientists have actually discovered this now. Part of why we sleep is that the brain is doing this consolidating process. That's not the only reason. In fact, it has been proven that we can die from sleep deprivation before we die from starvation.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, so we need sleep for more than just consolidation, but consolidation does take place during, it also takes place during other times, meditation or other quiet times when the brain isn't getting other stimuli. The amazing thing to me is the astronomical number of synapses and connection the brain is making all the time while we're just walking down the street or chewing gum.
So what else do you like about this book by Dr. Deutsch?
Well, the book makes the brain accessible to anyone. That's what I love about it the most. Because it tells stories about real people, and because it also integrates the information from neuroscience and neuroscientists, it helps us all change our perception about our own brain. And more than that, it helps us realize that we can change pretty much anything we want about us. We have the power because we all inherited this fabulous thing called the human brain. We have the power to become whoever we want to be. Now, most of us have heard that since the time we were children, but this book helps us actually see how that takes place. It gives us a more tactile experience because it shows us people who did it. And they're people just like you and I. They're nobody special.
Well, that's an optimistic note to end on, Glendalee. I've been talking to Glendalee Hoffman about one of her favorite books about the brain and specifically the science of neuroplasticity. And this is a book by Dr. Norman Deutsch, The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science. I might add that Glendalee is author of two books herself about the Kabbalah and the brain, The Secret Dowry of Eve, Woman's Role in the Development of Consciousness, and The Genesis Code, Your Key to Unlocking Hidden Genius. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.